The quest of our religion, the quest of every religion, the quest of metaphysics, the quest of ethical ways of thinking, the quests of the philosophers, the quest of the wisdom traditions, the quest of the ages is to answer well this question. You get such a small sliver of time on this planet. How do you live the good life? That is the pressing question of the religions, of the wisdom traditions, of the philosophies. What constitutes the good life, and how does one live it? And that being the case, I suggested last week that from many of the wisdom traditions and from the religious traditions, there has been this singular message, that one of the elements of living the good life is that we make our lives prayerful lives. Now, here's the thing. I say that knowing that many, if not most of you, are in the throes of a shift in how you think about your religion, and you have begun to see God differently, have begun to shape your religious practices differently, and consequently, many of us have forsaken the regular habit of prayer. And I said last week, if I do my job as a spiritual leader well, my hope for this lesson is to change your perspective on prayer and to give you the tools that you would need that as you move into this new dimension of spiritual understanding, that prayer would become once again a traveling companion. Now, I said that last week that even after this lesson, you're still going to have to fight off your laziness demons, just like I have to fight off my laziness demons. But my hope is that you'll have a track to run on and that you'll have a way of thinking about prayer, a way of praying that will resonate with your soul and will feel inviting and compelling to you. So, after the lesson last week, there were quite a few questions about prayer. I will answer some of those questions. Many of them I won't answer, and so I'm going to do that by email. But I've only gotten to the introductory remarks thus far, but what I'd like to ask us to do is to take some time and suspend all the assumptions that we have about prayer. Now, that's really hard to do. I mean, that's very, very difficult to do, but most of the questions that I saw last week were predicated on a set of assumptions that I'm going to work really hard to undercut and dismantle. So all these assumptions are going to go away, hopefully, which would then make the questions no longer relevant. So if you could suspend the things that you've been taught about prayer since you were in Sunday school, and by the time we get into this week a few lessons, I am hoping that the very word prayer will have a different meaning in your mind, hopefully in your soul. I said that what we were going to do is build this lesson on a central teaching of Jesus, and it is this. Jesus says, you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. You will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. And I'm going to suggest that whatever form prayer takes, whatever root behind the practices of this quest for truth, that will be informing of how we think about prayer. The quest of our souls for truth and the quest of our souls for the interior freedom that Jesus promised us. Well, if that's the foundation on which we build prayer, that's going to create a very different set of assumptions than we saw in the parable last week. We're not talking about prayer that tries to convince a reluctant deity to do what we need to be done. There will be nothing in this lesson that tries to get God to directly take care of this or that pressing need that we have. What we'll see is that indirectly, there's a great deal that has to do with taking care of need. But we won't be framing this as though we come to God with folded hands, we bow our heads, and we speak to the God out there and ask Him to take care of something for us here. So if that's not how we're going to be looking at prayer, how will we be looking at it? And I want to begin by looking at the ancient wisdom around the concept of seeing. Seeing is a very important theme in the Scriptures. Jesus said in Matthew 6 that the eye is the lamp of the soul. That if your eye is clear, He says, if your eye is good, then your life is going to be filled with light. But if your eye is clouded, or if your eye is unclear, then your life's going to be filled with terrible darkness. Well, that teaching of Jesus is a complement to the other one that we began with. You will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Because what he's saying is, if you don't see clearly, your blindness has profoundly toxic effect in your life. If you act on your blindness, then you're going to find that your instincts will betray you, that you will zig when you should have zagged. You'll be harsh when gentle would have been better. You will accommodate when you should have confronted. And zigging when you should be zagging tends to make a hash of our lives, of our relationships, of our jobs, of our friendships, and our habits. Zigging and zagging at the wrong times will cause the good life to elude us. And remember, what is the central question that religion asks? What is the good life, and how does one live it? Now, one of the markers of Jesus' ministry was the healing of blind people. And these stories are told generation after generation after generation after generation after generation. And as they are told, they take on more meaning than just what happened to this blind man or to that blind man, because we begin to see in the telling and the retelling and the re-retelling that there's a profound truth in these blindness healing stories. Because we realize along the way that we are all blind and that we need our vision and we need our outlook to be recalibrated. We need our perspective to be healed. And prayer, it turns out, prayer is a powerful means by which our vision is restored, by which our sight is made whole. I was speaking to a young man over the last several weeks whose vision is clouded. Now, his experience of life is slowly souring from within. It looks as to him as though he is losing his sense of color and his sense of taste, and his sense of joy and pleasure seems to be just seeping out of his life at a slow degree. Now, this young man is a top performer on his job. He's advancing rapidly in his career. He's the go-to guy whenever there's trouble on the job. In this season where so many are being laid off, he has survived and even thrived because everybody needs him. He works hard. He works long hours. He never says no to an opportunity. He's organized. He has his act together, and he is the guy that everybody wants on their team. But as he's going through his life, he's realizing that he's paying a dear price to be everybody's golden boy. He's married, he has a good marriage, but there's not much bandwidth left to give it the attention that it needs. A few cracks have begun to show in a previously healthy relationship. He regrets the time that he misses with his young children, and all the while that this loss of flavor and loss of color is happening, he's never once begun to question the can-do, make-it-happen posture that he takes toward his career. He's simply wondering if life is worth it. He's just wondering if this is all there is. He's never questioning the life that he's living. Now, as we've been talking about it over the course of these weeks, I asked him a series of questions about what constitutes the good life. And over the course of a few meetings, he realized that for him, the good life is the high-performance life. For him, the good life is the high-accomplishment life. It's the accolades of one's peers' life. It's the affirmation of one's superior's life. And so after some probing, I asked him if he thought that that definition of the good life had the legs necessary to go the distance. Will that version of the good life, will that take you to who you want to become? It will take you to being VP. It might even take you to being CEO. But will it make you who you most deeply want to be? Now, he's still thinking on that. I imagine he'll get back to me one of these times. But when we convene again, I'm going to suggest to him, as we are all well served in suggesting to ourselves, that the common human malady of blindness may have affected him. That it's possible that he has been blinded by the glittering facade of accomplishment. That it's possible that he's been blinded by the glittering facade of success and by the glittering facade of affirmation and validation. Because as good as all of those things are, as good as it is to be affirmed and validated, to succeed and to make accomplishments, the ancient wisdom has instructed us clearly that we are to keep those things in second place, because they are decidedly not the blueprint for the good life. They don't take us where we want to go. Now, I happen to have caught on to this particular life lesson early on because I grew up in one of the wealthiest zip codes in the nation, wealthier even than Beverly Hills. And so my wealthy friends lived in very fine houses with indoor and outdoor swimming pools. And as I would go over and visit in their $8 million homes, this is in 1974, as I would walk through their grand houses, where the thing that really struck me is one friend had a whole room just dedicated to his radio-controlled airplanes. But anyone who spent any amount of time there would very clearly see that no one would call theirs the good life, because they were acting happy behind these handsome walls, but it was painful to watch. Success in one area doesn't automatically translate into the good life. The human condition is riddled with blindnesses like this. The human condition causes us to not see clearly, to not even be able to see clearly what we most deeply want at the core of who we are. It's very difficult to know our own true desires. We don't see clearly what we're made for. We spend these few precious years that we have on this earth pursuing the thing that our blindness tells us that we want, only to get to the end and see that it's not worth what we thought it was worth. And this happens again and again and again. And it is happening unawares. It's happening to you. And this is what religion offers, is a way to learn from the wisdom of those who have gone before us, so that we don't get trapped by this ubiquitous condition of human blindness. Now, a life of prayer is a way that we would gain a true and a clear vision. A life of prayer affords us the possibility of seeing the universe with clarity, seeing people with clarity, seeing our own selves with clarity. Looking around at how we are responding in the midst of this current global crisis, you would probably agree with me that there's a good chance that we Americans don't see radical Islamists with a very clear eye. I know that Republicans and Democrats don't see one another with a clear eye, because we tend not to see our enemies or those who hurt us with the divine eye at all. And that's just one example of human blindness. The world that we live in is immersed in these illusory falsehoods, all of which have this powerfully deterministic effect on how we live our everyday lives. The world's full of people, wealthy people and poor people, successful people, unsuccessful people, people and doing stuff people, all of whom are chasing after the wind, all of whom are stressed over things that aren't stress-worthy, all of whom are on this rat wheel of accomplishment that in the end turns out to be not worth and not all that accomplished. And we do this because our eyes are not clear. We do this because of this chronic condition of human blindness. We don't see money clearly. We don't see possessions clearly. We don't see illness or health clearly. We don't see our own trials, our own troubles. We don't see our own failures clearly. We don't see the inevitability of our death clearly. But prayer, the ancients tell us, is a means by which we can be healed of our blindness. John, the writer in the Gospels, summed up the spiritual life, the praying life, this way: God is light, and in God there is no darkness. God is light, and in God there is no darkness. That makes it a simple question of seeing. Can you see? Are you seeing? Or are you blinded? And prayer becomes the answer to this human condition of blindness. It's the means by which we let divine light into our souls. It's the way that we see what we missed because we were raised by those who themselves were blinded. It's the way that we chase the darkness from our souls and we find ourselves in light. Prayer is reading a book, and in the reading, coming to see truth and being set free by that truth. Prayer is studying the way that healthy relationships work, and then having listened for the indwelling voice within to have seen our own unhealthy relationship patterns, and having seen it, to bring the light of God to bear upon those patterns and to change how we are with our loved ones. And this is prayer. Prayer is going to church and opening our hearts to the indwelling voice and sensing the light in the message, the life in the message, listening carefully and seeing in the face of our friends and smelling in the coffee and the bagels and having this experience of truth in the discussion time afterwards and allowing those experiences to awaken us to see what we didn't see and then acting on that. And this is prayer. Prayer is listening to a podcast of a man who understands human frailty and the humaneness that comes to us when we organize around our care for that frailty. And then being moved by listening to the podcast to then sit in quiet and reflect on how you may live more humanely toward those who are weak in your circle. And that becomes a way of overcoming blindness. That becomes prayer. Prayer is hearing the poem that we read during our songs and stories last week. What do you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? And then listening to that question all week and listening for the truth that emerges from within, that is always within us because the Spirit of God is within us, and asking ourselves, what will I do with my one wild and precious life? Prayer is the act of not turning our heads away from our own internal weaknesses and shortcomings, but looking squarely at them, such as our insatiable lust for pleasure, and then turning and challenging those things, for example, with a fast or with an act of temperance. Prayer is seeing an injustice and not allowing ourselves to turn our heads away, but giving our time and giving our money to set that injustice right. Prayer is opening our eyes to the beauty that is always there, and then making a point of intentionally savoring it and enjoying it. Prayer is going through troubles and asking God, the indwelling Spirit, what that trouble really means. Not just that it pains me, not just that I would like it to go away, not just how it's affecting me, but how it fits into a bigger picture, how it has this transformative effect upon me, and allowing truth and light and life to come bear upon me in the midst of my troubles. These are acts of prayer. They are regular practices that heal us from our blindness and give us clear sight, divine sight, true sight, informed sight. Now, you might have heard this word when you were in high school biology or remember it to this day. The word is heliotropism. It means the capacity of a plant to follow the sun as it moves through the sky. And so what happens is a flower will face the sun in the morning and will still be facing the sun in the evening. And this is a very good picture of prayer. It is the ability of the human heart to turn toward the divine, to turn toward truth, to turn toward goodness, and to turn toward beauty and turn toward light in whatever context, on whatever day, following whatever prayer form one chooses, the intentional turning of the human heart toward the divine light. This is prayer. So I give you these as a way of framing and saying, oh, that's a little bigger than I thought about prayer. Oh, that's a little different than asking a reluctant deity to take care of my sick child or my sick checkbook. Now, finding the light is not always easy. It's not even always possible. It's not easy because darkness is so ever-present in our day-to-day lives, but sometimes it's not even possible because the spiritual life includes many dark nights along the way. Times when, try as we might, we cannot find the light of God. We cannot find our way into truth. We cannot hear wisdom. We don't seem to be able to find our way to beauty. We don't sense understanding that would come from the indwelling voice of God. But at these times, as our hearts turn and turn and turn, looking in vain to find the light, these times too constitute prayer. For in these seasons, when the light is inaccessible, as we hold steadfastly to the practices, they tend to instill and deepen within us a hunger. We begin to recognize our appreciation of divine truth. We begin to recognize our appreciation of divine wisdom. We begin to recognize our appreciation of divine beauty because we are so devastated in its absence. So, when we practice the prayers of silence, or when we practice the prayers of reflection, or the prayers of learning, or the prayers of questioning, or the gnawing prayers like a dog gnawing on a bone, we are expressing a deep hunger inside of ourselves to see, to truly see. And we are expressing a hunger for light over darkness, for truth over illusion, for awakening over slumber. And when we see prayer this way, something happens in the daily practices. Often in the old way, prayer took on the form of a drudgery and a commitment, something that we did in order to cover our bases to make sure that God would take care of us, and something that we did in order to be pleasing to God so He wouldn't be displeased with us. But if we think of prayer this way, the practices begin to come out of a hunger for light, a hunger for illumination. They create a steady stream of light that will flow into our experiences every day. Because these practices of prayer open the possibility that we will see people more clearly, see our circumstances more clearly, interpret our troubles more clearly, go through the problems at work more cleanly, see the love of others and of life more clearly, more divinely. And when this happens, wisdom tells us. When we are steadfast in the practices of the prayer, when we rise to see the sun in quietness and reflection, when we create a routine around the truths of Scripture, when we mark certain rituals of our days with watchfulness, when we blend into our mid-morning coffee a moment to look for beauty, when we practice the classical spiritual disciplines of a daily examination of our souls, solitude, silence, reflection, meditation, study, confession, reconciliation, forgiveness. When we integrate these practices into prayer, we begin to express a quest from within ourselves to synchronize our lives with the divine rhythm of these ancient practices. Synchronize our lives with the regular streaming of light into the dark parts of our souls. Now the ancients had a word for this rhythm, this daily cadence, this part of life, this practice of seeing. They called it praying the office. Now it comes from a Latin word for work or workout. It's a daily pattern of exercising watchfulness for truth. We pause at fixed times each day in order to seek out light. The practice is as old as the Psalms. In Psalm 119:164, seven times a day I seek you, Lord. Seven times a day I stop my busy, busy mind. I stop my busy, busy activities and I look for the light. Seven times a day I step away from what it is that I am so engaged in and I watch for the divine. I watch for grace, and I watch for forgiveness, and I watch for peace. I look for wisdom. I look for insight and understanding. Seven times a day, I wonder to myself, is what I'm doing wise or is what I'm doing folly? Seven times a day, I ask myself, is the way that I'm responding to this difficult person at work, is this fear that my life is slipping away from me? Is this worry that I have that my kids are not going to turn out well? Is this drive that I have to finish the project on time? 7 days, I wonder to myself, is this energy that I am spending, is it born of truth or is it born of the blindness in my human heart? 7 times a day, I ask myself this question. And for those who make prayer a part of the rhythm of their lives, very often in the asking, there are answers to be found. There are whispers and there are nudges. We find that if we seek, sure enough, we find. If we ask, we are given. If we knock, the door is opened to us. Now, you might not be up to 7 times a day and up for that project, but perhaps as you hear the practices in the weeks to come, perhaps as you understand their intent to bring us into sight from blindness, perhaps if you understand that they are truth over illusion and freedom, you might be up for 2 times a day, maybe 3 times a day. So, I want to enjoin you to a set of practices intended to overcome this common human malady of blindness. I want to enjoin you to return to the practice of prayer, to the practice of awakening your soul to the light, the practice that is a hunger for divine truth, the practice of the truth that sets us free. Now, maybe the word return is not even the right word. Maybe this hasn't been the form of prayer that you've ever taken. And maybe this will be new material for you. So I'll begin next week talking about some of the specific practices that you may want to try. So Lord, to be alive to the truth and to be set free by it, to be healed of our blindnesses and to see the good life clearly, this is our desire. And so I pray it on behalf of these, your people, that you and I so love. Be it so, Lord, in Jesus' name. Amen.